Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on mushingradio.com. You can also follow us along on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Mushing Radio in the search bar, and you can hook right up with us. And without further ado, calling in from Southern California, our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. How are things up in Alaska?
It is going well. I'm sitting in downtown Anchorage tonight using a public Wi-Fi, and my temperature in the car says 58 degrees.
Oh, my gosh. That's yeah. A little bit warm.
That is warm, even for us Alaskans. It's time to break out the tank tops and the shorts at this weather.
So it looks like we are going to most likely have a winner overnight. Dallas Seavey is getting ready to leave White Mountain, should be leaving White Mountain in about the next 10 minutes or so. He's got a four-hour lead on his dad, Mitch. Aaron Burmeister is also in White Mountain, is another half-hour behind. And then Jesse Royer is almost 2 hours behind Aaron. So it would appear that unless there is some sort of catastrophic problem, that Dallas Seavey will likely win his third Iditarod early tomorrow morning.
Yeah, they're thinking between 3 and 5 a.m. Alaska time. That will be, I don't know, what is that, 7 and 8 o'clock, 8 and 9, between 7 and 9 o'clock on the East Coast. So all those folks that are getting up and have to go to work in the morning, they're probably going to miss the live finish unless they're sitting in their cubicles with the insider up and running. It's pretty rare that they'll finish that late in the morning, I guess, at least in the last few years, typically coming in 10, 11, 12 o'clock. So they're a little bit behind in terms of hours, but not necessarily in terms of days. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, it looks, I mean, obviously, as we saw last year, anything can happen in the last part of the race. So you never want to assume that someone is going to finish or that they're going to win until they actually come under the Burled Arch and Nome. But
right.
Dallas Seavey's team has just been very, very strong and very dominant. He had a really, really fast time into White Mountain. Looks like he's been about an hour faster than any of the other people in the top five. So unless there is a catastrophic weather event or, you know, something else completely unexpected happens, we can pretty much expect to see Dallas win his third Iditarod tonight.
You know, Alex, it's definitely something to talk about when you see both Dallas and Mitch coming in potentially first and second. And that really leads into our topic tonight about folks that are able to run the Iditarod effectively and competitively. And I posted something this morning on my Facebook page, as well as a couple of other Facebook groups that I follow on. And it's really sparked a lot of discussion today about the different types of races that people run. And I had mentioned early on this morning that unless you're in that top 20 teams or so of the Iditarod, many of those other folks, they are running and they're not running, quote unquote, very competitively, if you know what I mean. I'm not discounting them at all, but they don't have that chance of winning like those top guys do. And most of the reason why, I believe, is those top guys, they do this for a living. They are, quote unquote, professional mushers. This is what they do. And when you think about the Seaveys, that's exactly who we're talking about. They do this not only as a lifestyle, but as a profession. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And there are, you know, there are a couple of other top teams that really compete at that level. Certainly Ali Zirkel who's in SP Kennels with her husband Alan Moore. They are always very much in the top of rankings, and you know, to be able to, we've talked a lot in the past, not so much this year, but we've talked a lot about what it takes to run Iditarod and the resources required and the financial commitment required. It's a very substantial thing. It's not something you can really do on a whim or on a shoestring. And for the for a lot of the teams, especially teams that are 20 teams but not necessarily top 10 teams, they are always looking to move up so that they can attract more sponsors and get more money that they can put into their operation to make them more competitive. It's always interesting to me. I say that in any given year, there's usually about 12 to 15 teams who might be able to win given the right combination of events. And to get from being in the middle of the pack or even a top 20 finisher to being one of those teams that potentially could win, it really takes a lot in terms of resources, in terms of just having a big enough kennel that you can have access to enough dogs to really be competitive. And that is something that, it's very exciting to watch the people in the top five and the top 10, and it's very exciting to watch them compete. But I think sometimes fans might not realize all that it takes to get yourself in a position where you can really be competitive to go for the win.
You know, I mentioned this morning that unless you're in that top 20, even top 30, almost everybody else is missing some piece, whether it be financial, whether it be time commitment, whether it be family obligations, whether, you know, there's a myriad things that it takes to really get out there and really push the throttle down and be able to be competitive and potentially win something like this. And what always me, Alex, is how many of these folks that are in the middle tier and even the back of the Packers, the perennial middle of the pack and back of the Packers, their tenacity, how often that they do come back and run it every year and finish pretty much in the same position, give or take 5 or 10 positions, every single year, year in and year out. And I think a lot of that just has to do with missing one of those very critical pieces. When you have the resources of a King or a Booster or a Genre or a CV or a Mackey or any of the who's who of Iditarod, they have those pieces. And if mushers are listening, they know exactly what I'm talking about. What are your opinions on that?
I think you are absolutely right on the money. And sometimes it's something as simple as not having to have a day job. There are a lot
right.
of people who run dogs and also have full-time jobs. So they are getting up early and they are staying up late in order to train their dogs and then taking time off of their jobs for these 2 weeks to run Iditarod. That is something that is enormously stressful and takes a lot out of out of their quality of life. But it's something that they do because they are deeply, deeply committed to this and can't afford to do it any other way. So even just having someone who doesn't have to work full time, who is able to devote those 40 or 50 hours that they would spend at the job and going to the job with their dogs and running their dogs and training their dogs over the course of a year would make an enormous difference. And if you look at this not just as a one-year project, but as a multi-year project, if you can put in an extra 50 hours a week with your dogs over the course of 2 or 3 years, that's almost a lifetime.
Right. You know, Alex, one of the things that people have asked me more than anything about this today is I said on one of the posts that a lot of the mushers, in terms of middle to back of the Packers, they will often get a kennel of dogs that are often cast-offs from some other musher, and castoffs meaning they don't make their main team. They may be perfectly good mushing dogs, but they don't make the A teams for one of those top 10 kennels. And typically they get those dogs between 6, 7, 8 years old, and then they have plans of breeding their own dogs to be able to run the Iditarod on their own. But just as logistics, if you get a dog that's 8 years old, he or she is a little bit too old to be effective in Iditarod. And then if you have a batch of puppies, typically they can't run for at least 2 or 3 years, depending on how you're planning on doing things. So you have a very big gap there of you have dogs, but they're too old, and you have dogs, and they're too young. So it becomes almost a vicious cycle, one of those chicken or the egg or who crossed the road first types of things. It just turns into something that just isn't very successful for a lot of these folks.
Yes, you are absolutely right on that. And you know, there is nothing wrong with these. As you said, there's nothing wrong with these 7 or 8 year old dogs. It's just that they are past their prime, and they are not dogs that are going to be competitive on these top teams. So they'll be great dogs, and they can still be very effective in terms of training and helping get a team ready. But we've seen before that there's it's not really a science. There's an art to putting a dog team together, and you know, just as with a professional sports team of human beings, you know, if you put 10 or 12 or 16 people together, you've got to get the right mix, and you're never going to do as well with 16 superstars as you might with 3 or 4 superstars, and then a bunch of people who can really support. And I believe it's probably the same in putting together an Iditarod team. You want to have the best dogs possible, but you also want to make sure that beyond them just being good at their particular jobs, that they work well as a team and are able to support each other. And you would want to have dogs that can do a variety of different jobs in the team, so that if one is not working out as leader, you can mix it up and not have everything fall apart. Did I lose you? Are you there, Robert? I'm going to go on talking on the assumption that perhaps I lost you temporarily and you'll come back. So in this year's race, we've seen a lot of bunching up. There's been the top teams that are very competitive and doing very, very well. There's kind of a second tier of teams, the teams from about 5 to 20, 5th place to 20th place, that are behind the leaders enough that they are not going to challenge for the win, but are still doing very, very well. And then there's a large intermediate pack, the sort of solid middle of the pack teams. And that is, at the moment, that is teams from, from about 25 to maybe 45 or 50. And there's a lot of those teams. And some of them are fairly big names, Didi Genro and Thomas Werner, whom we talked about the other night, Ray Reddington Jr., Martin Boozer. Those teams tend to be really stacked up in the middle of the race. And we've seen that a lot this year, perhaps even more so than in previous years, because the race has been a little bit smoother, at least in terms of the course, certainly smoother than last year. Also, by not going over the Alaska Range, it's been a flatter and in some ways slightly easier course, although you never want to use the word easy when you're describing the Iditarod. So we've got this middle...
Alex, I apologize. Yes. I got cut off there. I am back on the air, so we're still here, and thank you for covering for me when we dropped the call.
Excellent. I decided that it would be best to just keep talking because I figured you would come back.
No problem. That's what makes you a good co-host. We have about 14 minutes left, Alex. I know we're on a very hard break here this evening on our show, and I want to make sure that we get in our Musher profile for the evening. Any last words in regards to this topic today? You know, I know it's a very touchy one for a lot of fans. Everybody has their favorites, and even when you think about other sports, you know, there are still people that are diehard fans in football for the Jacksonville Jaguars and the Oakland Raiders and teams that never win, but they still fill their stadiums. And Mushing is very much the same. Everybody has their fans, and everybody's rooting for everybody to win. But for a lot of folks, it's a tough road to haul, especially when you're dealing with all the factors that we talked about tonight.
Absolutely. The only other thing that I wanted to mention with regard to this is there was a great interview that that was done earlier in the race at Kuslia by Matthew Smith, who I believe works for Canome, and he interviewed Martin Boozer. And people might recall that Martin was very, very close to the front of the pack early in the race and then got into Kuslia and decided that he wanted to totally change up his race plan. And what had happened is he came into Kuslia and there was a handwritten cardboard sign that was written by one of the local teenagers that just said, "We look up to you." And Martin said that when he saw that, he suddenly realized that this is what's important, is traveling throughout Alaska and meeting the people in the villages and spreading the love of mushing and the dogs. That's what he should be focused on rather than pushing himself to try to win another Iditarod title. And a lot of people could say, well, I'm not sure that he would have won even if he had pushed his dogs harder. And certainly someone like Martin who has that much experience would know whether he was just doing well in the early part of the race or whether he really had a chance to win. But it says a lot about him and his, and his devotion to the sport that he was able to recognize that and see that his priorities needed to be adjusted and make that adjustment in the middle of a race where he was very, very competitive.
One last question in regards to this, Alex. I know that you have followed the back of the Packers, and your movie, Mush the Movie, spent a lot of time talking with and about these people. What do you think will happen in the evolution of the Iditarod? I had mentioned that they're running it so fast now that often those guys are getting kind of rolled up and left behind. What's your opinion of that, and what do you think should happen in the evolution of this race?
I would hope there would still be a place for people who are running the race more slowly and who are running the race as a one-time thing or a two-time thing for people who really want to make the trip through Alaska and through this backcountry and then just get to Nome. I know that you had mentioned in your post the idea of reviving the Serum Run Expedition, which I think is a great idea as well, because that takes away the competitive aspect but still lets people appreciate and travel to all of these villages and lets them really be part of the history and reconnecting with the history and what dog mushing means to Alaska.
Exactly. I think that's something that has to be talked about and entertained. And, you know, everybody wants to be involved in the competition. That's kind of our mode of thinking as humans. We want to be first or at least complete everything, whether it's virtual badges on Facebook or life-defeating feats, like the Iditarod. I don't think life-changing feats such as the Iditarod. We as humans are wired a little bit differently that we want to compete
whether against ourselves or against somebody in front of us. It's going to evolve eventually into the sport, and hopefully it doesn't leave a lot of those folks, more than two-thirds of those folks, left behind. I would hate to see that happen. Alex, what are we talking about tonight in terms of our musher profile, our last one, I assume, of the 2015 Iditarod?
Tonight I wanted to talk a little about Heidi Sutter. Heidi is currently in 50th place. She is very solidly in the middle of the pack. She grew up in Maine, moved to Alaska after high school because she saw pictures of it and wanted to live in a beautiful place that didn't have lots and lots of people crowded together. She went to Sheldon Jackson College and graduated, but then she became a victim of domestic abuse and wound up homeless and living in the Fairbanks area. She started mushing by answering a newspaper ad for someone looking for a handler, and says that she was paid in mostly in 7-Up and Snickers bars, but learned about dogs and dog care and dog racing. And she says that mushing and working with dogs is what literally saved her life. And she and her husband, Darren Lee, and their daughter own and operate KMA Kennel, which is a small kennel with 19 huskies in, and forgive me for murdering this name, Chistochina, which is a small town in the Copper River Basin that has 50 people and 80 dogs. In addition to racing, and they both have raced, he raced the Yukon Quest, they use their dogs to haul wood and also use their dogs on a trap line. She said that when her daughter was younger, she and her husband and her daughter would go trick-or-treating by dog sled. And Heidi is one of the many mushers who has a day job. She's a full-time teacher and works as both a regular teacher and a special education teacher, specializing in working with children diagnosed with autism and severe behavioral issues. This is her first 1,000-mile race, although she ran the Yukon Quest 300 last year, and it said that she wants to run the 1,000-mile Yukon Quest next year. This year in Anchorage, her Iditarider in the race was a young girl who had cystic fibrosis, who became an Iditarider through the Make-A-Wish Foundation. There's a great YouTube video that we'll put up on Facebook interviewing her Iditarider, and at the end she says that when she grows up she wants to be a musher. Heidi has talked publicly about her history with domestic abuse. And has some people, when she said that she was running Iditarod to raise awareness about domestic abuse, people started saying that she was very inspirational and a real role model. And she said publicly that this embarrassed her because she thinks of herself as just a normal mom and teacher and person who loves dogs. However, she is very clear that she wants to use her run, her Iditarod run this year, to help raise awareness about domestic violence, which is a huge problem all over the U.S. and a very big problem in Alaska. And it's her hope that someone who learns that she was a victim and was able to pull herself out of it and go on to run a 1,000-mile dog race would realize that they can do things and they can get help as well. So the other thing is, if you see pictures of her just before the Iditarod, I believe about a week before, she dyed the tips of her hair a very, very bright pink to help her stand out. So if you see her and she is not wearing a hat, she will be the one with the very, very bright pink hair.
That's what I was going to say. You definitely cannot miss Heidi out there on the trail with her pink hair. And I believe she did the same thing last year on the Yukon Quest 300. I believe she had a very bright blue. So everybody, you know, musher personalities are definitely very unique. Everybody has has their own little niche that they do. When we think about these guys, you know, when you think about Hugh Neff, you think about the Cat in the Hat and those sorts of things. Everybody has their little, I guess it would kind of be like an alter ego, huh Alex?
Yeah, an alter ego, or I guess if we think back to the conversation with Tony last night, it's part of your branding of yourself.
Right.
You know, when you see a musher in the Cat in the Hat thing, you know that's Hugh Neff.
Right.
And you don't even have to think about it. You always know that it's there. I think these kind of things also make the race more fun for fans. It's it helps bring out the personalities. It helps make it clearer who it is that you're following. So I always enjoy learning these things about mushers, and I always enjoy when mushers have particular things that they use to make them stand out.
Me too. You know, Alex, in closing, we have received such wide support over the last week or so from fans all over the world that have contacted us and sent us very nice messages. And I know you have people that you want to thank and give shout-outs to, but I want to give a thanks and a shout-out to all those fans out there that have listened to us. What is this, our fourth year or so doing this together, Alex?
Yeah.
It's great that we reach so many people, and people are taking the time out of their day to listen to a couple of guys talk about our opinions on Iditarod.
Yes, and it's and obviously we both have a lot of opinions, so that's helpful. But I think the other thing that people have told me that they appreciate is that we're interested in a lot of different aspects of the race, and we've talked about a lot of different aspects of the race and about mushing in general. And, I think we both are just huge fans of
right.
dog mushing in general and the Iditarod in particular.
I live it every day, and this is my chance to talk about it with you, Alex. Every year, I look forward to it, and until we see each other on the trail, and that's going to happen one of these years where we're both out there on that Iditarod trail. You're making a movie or telling a story, and I'm trudging down the trail with my team of dogs. I think we're going to continue to do this, at least for the foreseeable future, until one of us gets tired of talking to ourselves on the radio.
Yeah. I just want to mention real quickly, we had two scratches today. Jan Steves, who was a previous Red Lantern winner, scratched in Huslia, and Catherine Keat scratched in Unalakleet. She only had 9 dogs left. So we still have 69 teams on the trail. Cindy Abbott is the current Red Lantern, resting in Koyukuk. But we have a lot of teams moving forward. And as we mentioned, most likely between 3 and 5 in the morning Alaska time, we will have a winner.
Alex, is the finishers banquet, is that Saturday or Sunday night? Do you recall?
I believe it's Sunday night. Yeah.
Sunday night. And for the last few years, everybody on the trail has been able to make that banquet. So, like you said, Cindy is currently in last place, and I'm sure that could change several times over the next few days. But I believe that everybody will be in this year in order to attend that banquet. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think almost everybody will be in. You have to remember that we essentially started a day later, because usually would be on Sunday. So hopefully everyone will be in, but it looks like at the most, there might be 2 or 3 teams that are still on the trail when the banquet happens.
All right, Alex, we're just about out of time. I want to thank everybody that has taken their time out of their day to listen to us on the radio, and I will talk to Alex off air on whether we're going to do any more shows this year, and we'll definitely let you know. Alex, it has been a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay. Thanks very much, Robert, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Mushing Radio. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.